Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thank you for listening to Sound Optometry. Just a reminder that you will no longer receive a CPD point by listening to this episode of the podcast. But if you subscribe and listen to the most recent episodes of Sound Optometry, you can gain CPD points. I hope you enjoy this episode of Sound Optometry. Hello, I'm Michelle Hanratty. Welcome to Sound Optometry, the podcast from Docket that provides high-quality continuing professional development for all GOC-registered optometrists. With case studies and in-depth conversations, each month we explore the topics that matter the most to us optometrists. You can gain one CPD point by listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on our website, docket.info. Every month, we ask you to write in with your suggestions for topics to cover on the podcast, and this month we've done just that. This episode on hydroxychloroquine monitoring was suggested to us by Janice McCrudden. I'll let her do the introduction.
My name's Janice McCrudden. I'm an IP optometrist based in Northern Ireland, and I do various things. I work in the hospital eye service, I do some assessing for the college, and I'm also involved in medical legal work, which is how I came across this case that we're going to discuss today.
So why did you suggest that we cover hydroxychloroquine monitoring in community optometry?
Well, I came across a 37-year-old female patient who had lupus. And when I started reading the case, I was really surprised at how quickly her vision had gone down. And I just thought it was really worth highlighting this to other colleagues because I asked a few friends and things about it. And they really were astounded as much as I was because we all know about it. But within, you know, weeks, this patient's vision was really deteriorating from good to poor.
Can you give me a little bit more information about the timeline here?
She was diagnosed with lupus in 2009 and started on hydroxychloroquine and 400 milligrams a day. She started noticing some problems in June 2017. She felt driving at night maybe wasn't so good. She was struggling a little bit with reading. So she came into the optometrist in July 2017. Vision was 6-6, right and left. The optometrist has recorded everything correctly, had a good look at the macula, did an OCT and said, you know, maybe you should just go to your GP and get your bloods checked and everything else because I can't see any reason why you'd be struggling. So the patient went to her GP, got blood checks, diabetes, everything came back as normal. And then she started to have more problems. So we're talking a month later, in August 2017, she went back to the same practice. And her vision's now 6-12 right and left. And this is only a matter of 4 or 5 weeks later. And the records at the optometrist show query slight mottled appearance at the macula. And the optometrist acted quite appropriately and referred on to ophthalmology then. And it was an urgent referral to ophthalmology. The patient self-presented at the beginning of September to eye casualty, feeling as if her vision had gotten much worse. And at this stage, it was 6-15 minus right and left. The patient was really starting to struggle. So at eye casualty, they felt this might be a toxicity reaction and they advised stopping the medication and contacted rheumatology and also referred the patient onto a general ophthalmology clinic.
And did her vision continue to get worse?
3 weeks later, the vision right and left is now 6-36. So we've gone in the space of July, October from 6-6 right and left to 6-36. And my most recent data on the patient is 2021. And the patient is right 6-48 minus and 6-60 minus. So when I came across this case, I just thought the dramatic and quick fall in vision was really worth noting. And I knew about toxicity, but did not realize in any respect it could go down so quickly.
Yeah, it's actually really quite surprising to hear that because I didn't know it could go down that quickly either. And I suppose it really highlights the need to be aware when you are taking a history to have that really high degree of suspicion. If there is something that the patient's telling you that you can't explain, it really does need following up and relies on someone connecting the dots, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. And that was where I just thought that some training on this really just to raise awareness.
Monitoring patients who take hydroxychloroquine is of vital importance, as changes to the retina can appear rapidly and they're irreversible. At the moment in the UK, the monitoring is usually done in secondary care. But today we'll explore how primary care optometry can play a more useful role. A pioneering example of this is a pilot service in Cardiff, where optometrists are inviting patients who take hydroxychloroquine long-term to have their eyes monitored. And it works in a similar way to patients with diabetes. To understand this better, I'm joined by Sharon Beattie, an optometrist, and one of her patients on the trial service, Sonia.
My name is Sonia, and I have a condition called lupus, which I've had for about 13 years, but I suspect it's actually longer than that. It was diagnosed 13 years ago.
And Sharon, can you explain who you are and what you do as well?
Hello, my name is Sharon Beattie. I'm an optometrist working in high street practice, but I became involved with the planning of this monitoring service in my previous role as optometric advisor to Cardiff and Vale University Health Board.
Thank you. So Sonia, can you just perhaps briefly explain what lupus is?
So lupus is a long-term autoimmune condition in which the immune system attacks healthy tissue. And it can cause inflammation in lots of different body parts. There are different types of lupus. I have what's called systemic lupus. So it has the potential to affect any part of my body, my organs, joints and tissues.
And so you're on hydroxychloroquine for your lupus. Can you talk me through your sort of drug regime?
So I was diagnosed about 13 years ago. And up until 1 year ago, I was taking 400 milligrams every day. And over the last year, I have been alternating 400 and 200.
Okay. And were you aware that hydroxychloroquine could affect your eyes?
I was told initially that it could be one of those side effects. But at that time, I was dealing with much more serious and immediate issues with the lupus, which had just been diagnosed. So I just took it like if you were to read paracetamol side effects, I mean, it would scare you to bits. So at that time, that's how I just responded to it and took it in my stride.
Were you aware that you needed to have your eyes checked, though?
I think, yes. I believe that they took photographs of my eyes, but I didn't pay too much attention at the time.
Yeah, so 13 years ago, that might well have been a baseline photograph. And the guidelines have changed since then. Sharon, can you tell me about the new service, the new monitoring service, why it's unique and what it's setting out to achieve?
Well, the aim of the service is to monitor those patients taking hydroxychloroquine or chloroquine to look for signs of hydroxychloroquine retinopathy, because the retinopathy manifests itself as damage to the photoreceptors and subsequent degeneration of the retinal pigment epithelium that we know as RPE. So this may produce a bullseye maculopathy and central visual field loss. So the monitoring service is really important, as the only intervention to prevent further damage is actually by stopping the drug. So in 2019, the Welsh Government had consulted with stakeholders around optometry contract reform proposals in Wales to enable patients that have historically been seen in hospital ophthalmology services to be seen in high street optometry practices by those practitioners who've obtained higher qualifications. So in 2022, agreement was reached that the hydroxychloroquine monitoring service would be part of optometry contract reform, which will be rolled out in Wales later this year. And Cardiff and Vale Health Board agreed to be the first health board in Wales to start and pilot the service in an optometry practice before it is rolled out in some high street optometry practices, which is a first in the UK.
So the service hasn't been running very long. It's very much a pilot service at the moment. For a patient like Sonia, what tests do they typically undergo when they come into the clinic?
So the optical assistant measures the patient's vision and the patient body weight. And then the patient has wide field fundus autofluorescence images taken and a spectral domain OCT scan of the macula. And the optical assistant also performs specific visual field tests on the patient. So then I assess all the patient results as we have access to the software to view the visual fields, the images and the scans while the patient is in the waiting room so we can understand the outcome of the assessment. So then I invite the patient back into the consulting room, check that the medication list is correct, and we also check whether the patient's taking tamoxifen or have renal problems as this increases the risk of retinal toxicity. And then we have a chat with the patient, explain the reason for the appointment, check that the patient understands that this doesn't replace their sight test with their optometrist. And then we show the patient the scans to explain what part of the eye we are examining. And then we ask the patient if they have any questions and provide an information leaflet. And then we then update the open eyes electronic patient record, which the consultant also has sight of. And then the patient is then free to leave at that point.
Do patients get an interpretation of their results, or do you just show them the photograph just to keep them informed, but not necessarily discuss the results too much at this stage?
So we do show the patient the macular CT scan, and we explain that these tests are used to find changes, usually before the patient would notice any changes to their vision. If the test results are normal, we inform the patient there and then in the consulting room, and that they will be called back in a year's time. And then the letter is always sent to the patient, the GP and the prescribing doctor. If we suspect toxicity, or if any of the test results are abnormal in any other way, we do then advise the patient that we will contact the consultant electronically to review all the results virtually. If the consultant is then happy with the results, then we advise the patients by letter that all is normal. But we do advise the patient while they're with us in the waiting room that if the consultant is not completely happy with the results, he will contact the patient directly and then arrange for the patient to see him in the hospital for further examinations and a discussion on next steps.
Sonia, what was it like to see these images of the back of your eye?
Oh, I found them fascinating, and I think I was quite nosy. I don't know if Sharon remembers that.
I remember.
And I did ask them if they could show me something where it was abnormal, just so I could compare it. But yes, it was very reassuring to have them interpreted in front of you. When you have a serious condition like mine, anything else that goes wrong is a cause for concern. And so I'm just very grateful that this service is being provided. So for me, knowing that this is now taking place, I can just put it aside and not think about it and not worry about it, because if there was something wrong, they would catch it at a much earlier stage.
How does the service link up to the other areas of NHS care for lupus, Sonia?
My understanding is that the service links in with both the rheumatologist that I would be under and an ophthalmologist, because I also suffer from dry eyes, which is also a symptom sometimes of lupus and other related autoimmune conditions. So there is some cross-working there. And I think particularly, as Sharon mentioned, they just let them know electronically. These days, communication is so much different to when I first was diagnosed, and I'm able to email my consultant. So there's much faster transmission of information. And that's very reassuring to me as a patient.
And I think, Sharon, what really strikes me about this service, as Sonia's described, is the improved communication between the different healthcare professionals that are involved in her care. And I think that can only benefit the patient in the long term.
Absolutely. I mean, we're very excited in Wales because we're going to have rollout of Open Eyes electronic patient record, both in hospital clinics and in all optometry practices. And as Sonia said, this has enabled such fast electronic communication between the consultant ophthalmologist, and it's safe and it's secure and it's efficient. And we can produce outcome letters within Open Eyes, which pulls out the data from the patient record. So again, both the optometrist and the consultant able to view all images and results. So shared care can be provided for patient benefit. And essentially only those patients that have to go to see a consultant actually do so, which again is freeing up capacity, which we know at this time is challenging in secondary care. So great example of how technology and collaboration can be used for patient benefit.
And hopefully we will begin to see the service being set up in primary care practices in the rest of the UK as well then. Sharon, thank you very much. And Sonia, thank you to you as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, Rhianna Reynolds, a consultant ophthalmologist in Cardiff, will tell us why she set up the pilot service in Wales. You're listening to Sound Optometry with me, Michelle Hanratty. Every month, we explore the topics that matter the most to us optometrists. So if you've got any suggestions that you think your colleagues would benefit from hearing, email us. The address is podcast@dockets.info. In this episode of Sound Optometry, we're exploring monitoring for patients who take hydroxychloroquine. To dive deeper, I'm joined by Rhiannon Reynolds. Rhiannon set up the pilot service that we just heard about.
Hi, my name's Rhiannon Reynolds. I'm a consultant ophthalmologist in an Aberdeen University Health Board with a specialist interest in medical retina. I'm also the Islwyth or Vice Chair of the Royal College of Ophthalmologists in Wales.
So we just heard from Sonia, one of the patients that uses the new service for monitoring for hydroxychloroquine. And also we heard from Sharon, who's one of the optometrists working within that service. You helped set it up, didn't you? So why did you decide that this was needed?
Well, ophthalmology within Wales in particular is a hugely overstretched service at the moment. And we just couldn't accommodate in secondary care the needs of the patients taking hydroxychloroquine. We just didn't have the capacity to be able to take on a monitoring service. And really, monitoring services are not really the remit of secondary care anyway. But this did leave patients exposed to risk. So we wanted to set up a national hydroxy monitoring service, really where we move monitoring into primary care. And in that way, we can utilise the enhanced roles of optometrists in primary care with higher certificates in medical retina.
So how does this service, this new service, how do you see it fitting in with other hospital departments when it comes to patient care?
At the moment, as I said, this is only a pilot service, and the patients we're using here are patients who've already been referred into the ophthalmology department at the University Hospital of Wales and have been sat on a database, and these are the patients we're currently looking at. But in the future, the guidelines are that the prescriber of the hydroxychloroquine is responsible for referring into the service. So we will need to have a standard referral from these services into the monitoring service, much like the diabetic screening service is the ideal. And then this will come into a central hub, and then they're distributed to the closest practice. So really, it's a matter of communication and education within not only the hospital I service, but these wider hospital departments as well, such as rheumatology, dermatology, gastroenterology, all these people who actually do the prescribing of hydroxychloroquine, and also our GP practices, because actually a lot of these patients start their treatment within secondary care, but then actually are discharged to the care of the GP for their further prescriptions.
You've already mentioned the diabetic screening service. The impact of that has been huge. So what do you expect the impact of this service to be?
Well, we know the numbers of patients on hydroxychloroquine, but actually on an area by area basis, it's been quite difficult to determine how many in each area will require this service. We know from prescribing data from primary care, so I'm talking about GPs, there's about 6,000 patients a year who are likely to need this service. That's just for Wales, which isn't as great as the diabetic screening service, but very much like the diabetic screening service, this retinal toxicity is important to be caught before it causes any visual impact for the patient, because we know that once visual damage is there, it can't be reversed. So we don't really know, because there hasn't been a screening service like this. And Wales has really led the way on this, because we were the forerunners in the diabetic screening service as well. So hopefully we'll be able to demonstrate the importance of this in terms of picking up not only pathology actually with patients with hydroxychloroquine toxicity, but what we've found in the pilot is actually we're picking up other things as well that might need care that these patients haven't noticed before.
And what's the prevalence of retinopathy?
So the data which prompted the provision of the guidelines showed that there was approximate prevalence of 7.5% of patients who are taking hydroxychloroquine for more than 5 years. What we're finding actually with the various different small monitoring services is this might be different. But also, if we do the right analysis on this data, we may find that actually the preclinical changes may even be higher than that. But what we do know is around 7.5, and that's what the guidelines were based on.
So thinking about hydroxychloroquine itself, what is it used for? And when did we start using it to treat patients?
So hydroxychloroquine itself is quite an interesting drug. It was first discovered in 1638 by the Spanish who were occupying Peru. The indigenous Inca people had been using it for generations, and they'd been using it to treat malaria. And it's taken from the bark of a particular tree there. So this powder then from the bark started being imported into Europe. And in the 1700s, the British troops occupied India, and they were trying to give quinine to their soldiers to prevent their malaria. But it was very bitter. So they mixed it with some sugar and water and created a tonic, or tonic water. The soldiers were still a little reluctant, so then they added gin to it, and the gin and tonic was born. I'm not sure you get the same benefit these days from gin and tonic, unfortunately. Then in the 1950s, a synthetic form was used and became widely available. But what we noticed then, the use of it for malaria, that it was also active in autoimmune conditions.
Sonia, who we heard from earlier, has lupus, but what other conditions is hydroxychloroquine used to treat?
It's used in many conditions with rheumatology, and the most commonly prescribed condition is for rheumatoid arthritis. But there's other conditions such as antiphospholipid syndrome. In dermatology, it's used for things for lichen planus. It's very, very widely used. And although it does have a side effect profile, as all medications do, it's usually very, very minimal and patients tolerate it extremely well, which is why it's generally a first-line treatment in lots of these conditions.
What's the difference between hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine when it comes to the guidance?
So chloroquine is more toxic, not only with other side effect profiles, but also in the eyes as well. So if you're taking chloroquine as opposed to hydroxychloroquine, it is recommended that monitoring starts after a year of taking.
As opposed to the 5 years for hydroxychloroquine?
As opposed to the 5 years, yeah.
And are there any other risk factors that may be relevant, which means that a patient has to start screening earlier than the 5 years?
So if you're taking a dose more than 6.5 milligrams per kilogram of body weight, you're at a higher risk and the monitoring should start earlier. If your kidneys don't clear the drug as well, so if you've got some kidney dysfunction, that should also start monitoring earlier. And especially if you take other medications which have shown to be retinal toxic, especially tamoxifen, then you should start monitoring earlier than the 5 years planned.
So if we do see someone in community practice, what are the early red flag signs or symptoms that might indicate that retinopathy might be starting to rear its head?
When you're just looking at the back of the eye, when you're doing your fundoscopy, then you may have a mottling type appearance around the macular region as an early sign. Once you develop in sort of stark bullseye maculopathy, the patients are certainly going to be complaining of vision loss at that point. If you have an OCT in practice, you'd start noticing what's called a loss of the ellipsoid zone. So the very sort of subfoveal area, the photoreceptor layers, you start developing what's called a flying saucer sign. So you start seeing this thinning of the photoreceptor layer in the parafoveal region on an OCT. The visual field defects, every practice tends to have a visual field machine. Really, you need one like a Humphreys field, and you might sort of get patchy, non-specific loss on that. You might start noticing, particularly in the supranasal quadrant, you start getting loss in that region, but it might be patchy and non-specific. As it progresses, you start developing the classic ring scotomas. But again, these are not early signs, the ring scotoma. You just might notice a slightly unusual visual field defect. If you're lucky enough to have autofluorescence in the community, that can be quite an early indicator. So with autofluorescence, what happens is the lipofuscin within RPE cells, when RPE cells are not functioning well, when they're sick for some reason, they fluoresce. So autofluorescence is an excellent tool for looking at sick RPE for whatever reason. And particularly in hydroxychloroquine toxicity, it gives you this very characteristic parafoveal luminance, sort of early ring type fluorescence around the fovea. So you may notice that even before the patient's really complaining of any visual symptoms.
And what actually changed with the new guidelines? Because the new guidelines came out in 2020. So what's different in those guidelines compared to what was being done before?
So the main difference really with that is that there's no baseline monitoring. So the initial guidelines asked for a review prior to or just after starting hydroxychloroquine. And what they actually found regarding that is the baseline review added nothing in terms of treatment. And also, quite a lot of people who are started on hydroxychloroquine, there's about 8,000 people across the UK each year started on hydroxychloroquine. Quite a significant proportion of those never reach the 5 years. So they're unlikely to have developed toxicity unless obviously they have their other risk factors. So that's why it wasn't an initial baseline recording that needed to be done. There's also the tests that are recommended within the guidelines. So the minimal tests they expect to be able to be done are the OCT and the autofluorescence. If both of those are abnormal, then the patient is almost certainly have toxicity and should be referred into secondary care. If one of them is abnormal, the patient should then go on to have a visual fields test. The 10-2 is the one that's recommended because that's the one that picks up the parafoveal defects. Again, if that is abnormal, then they can be referred into secondary care. If that is normal, then what the guidelines recommend is actually they then go on to have electrodiagnostic assessment and a multifocal ERG. However, this isn't always available. But there's very few patients who show an abnormal OCT or autofluorescence who don't also have a visual field defect. We actually think now that the visual field defect actually might be one of the more sensitive tools. The important thing to note with the patients that are referred in for toxicity, it's not the ophthalmologist's role to stop hydroxychloroquine, and certainly the optometrist in primary care who picks up the toxicity should not be telling the patient to stop hydroxychloroquine, because we're not fully aware of the reasons they're taking it and the impact on their systemic health that this might have. So this is a decision that needs to be taken with the primary prescriber. So once they come into secondary care, the person who prescribes the hydroxychloroquine needs to be informed, and it needs to be them that stops the treatment rather than us in eye care.
How urgently would you say that hydroxychloroquine is generally stopped?
This is a disease process that has taken 5 years to develop. It's not something that's going to change overnight. So if there is a small lag in stopping hydroxychloroquine, I'm talking about weeks, it's unlikely to have a significant impact on their eye disease. So it's urgent, but it's not an emergency, same day type of problem.
Rhiannon, thank you very much for joining me today.
Thank you very much.
To close this episode, I wanted to leave the final message to Janice McCrudden. She told us about the case of a rapidly deteriorating patient at the start of the podcast, and she explained what the key messages are for optometrists across the four nations of the UK, even if there isn't a universal hydroxychloroquine monitoring service.
I think just be suspicious of any patient. You know, the patient, her symptoms in June when she came into the optometrist in July were just, she just didn't feel her vision was the way it had been previously, even though it's measuring 6.6 on the chart. And they checked the macula. I mean, we all know the tests we're supposed to do. The college has the guidance and the fields and all of that. And I think just keep doing what you're supposed to do, but you should have a very low threshold for suspicion with these patients.
So it's about being aware of all the appropriate tests and what all the early presentations are. So I think it's good to have patients that are better educated as well as optometrists.
Yes, I think just remember that this condition can be quite debilitating quite quickly.
So I think that's the key message, isn't it? That it is irreversible and it's all about prevention.
Mm-hmm.
Janice, thank you very much.
Thank you all.
If you go to docket.info and search for Sound Optometry, you can also find the additional reading materials and resources for this episode. By listening to this podcast and completing the short exercise on the website, you can gain one CPD point covering professionalism and clinical practice. We'll be back with another deep dive next month. Until then, we'd really appreciate it if you help spread the word about the podcast. Tell your colleagues to listen and subscribe to the series on your podcast app so you don't miss an episode. The producer is Jason Hoskin. I'm Michelle Hanratty. Thanks for listening.